All right, thank you, Sue. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The third case on our oral calendar this afternoon is Rupam Sinha versus Deepak Kadamani, court file A20-0838. Even though we're appearing virtually here via Zoom, as you both know, our rules are the same, meaning each side here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording the proceedings here today as we normally would, so please identify yourselves for our record when you begin your arguments. And so with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Kaynord Hunt and I represent the appellant cross respondent Deepak Kadamani. The issues have been fully briefed and in the limited time available this afternoon, I would like to address three categories of issues raised by appellant before the court, which require a reversal. They are the trial court's determination of marital and non-marital property, the $6,000 in temporary spousal maintenance awarded a respondent for 4 years, and the multiple awards of attorney's fees against appellant. Now, the trial court took over $900,000 in assets of a non-party, appellant's father, and ordered them divided between the parties in this marital dissolution action. This error must be reversed. Appellant's father deposited over $900,000 in two joint accounts with appellant. The funds and a condominium purchased by appellant's father with his funds are not the party's marital property subject to division. There's no dispute that under Minnesota law, specifically Minnesota Statute 524.6-203 sub A, that a joint account belongs to, during the lifetime of the joint account holders, to each party in proportion to the net contributions by each to the sum on deposit, unless there is clear and convincing evidence of a different intent. Now, it's undisputed that appellant's father is the sole source of the funds for the two joint accounts at issue on appeal. Appellant's expert, Howard Kaminsky, by tracing, determined appellant put none of his own funds into either of the two Fidelity joint accounts, nor had he received any distributions from those accounts. And Mr. Kaminsky's tracing was not challenged. And pursuant to Minnesota law, appellant as a joint account owner has no ownership in the funds deposited by his father. For the funds to belong to the parties, they had to prove, and the trial court had to find, there was clear and convincing evidence that appellant's father deposited the funds in the joint accounts with the present intent they were an irrevocable gift to the parties. There is no such evidence in the record. The two Fidelity accounts and the condominium must be removed from the marital dissolution balance sheet. The trial court also committed error in its conclusion that the parties have no marital interest in the Birmingham, England flat. Respondent claimed there was no marital interest, but she did not meet her burden of proof. During the marriage, the flat was rented out, but respondent failed to account for the rental income. Respondent's brother collected the rent, put it into his own account, which he regarded as his funds, and paid down the mortgage with his funds. And respondent's brother admitted he couldn't prove that the rental income was not used, and it's respondent's burden to show that the mortgage was paid down with non-marital funds, which burden she did not meet. When real property is acquired before the marriage, and rental income, which is marital, is used during the marriage to reduce the mortgage debt, as the Minnesota Supreme Court declared in the Anton case, the Schmitz formula applies to determine marital, non-marital interest. Respondent presented no facts by which her non-marital interest was established in accord with Minnesota law. Because respondent didn't so establish, the flat should be declared marital with a value assigned to it of $125,000, $125,014. Turning to spouse and maintenance.
Ms. Hunt, it's Judge Riley. I didn't see that you disputed that your client received the bonus earned in 2017, but paid in February of 2018.
That's correct. And the trial court actually made findings of with regard to that, both in when it was talking about appellant's ability to pay spousal maintenance and also about his ability to pay need-based fees.
Right. My question, and I'm aware of that in the record. My question to you is that there were two different figures talked about. One was $86,000, the other one was $107,000. Which one do you think is right?
The $86,000.
And why is that?
Because that's what my client actually received. And that is what respondent presented to the trial court at the time of trial. It was only post-trial that the respondent switched the figure. So it would be the 86.
And then I had a question just with regard to the arithmetic on the conduct-based attorney's fees. When I read your briefing, there was a finding at it's finding 379 that the total conduct was almost $16,000. But when I read your brief, it seems that you are just contesting the $10,000 from that fourth day of trial, along with the $3,200 for the denied Rule 52 motion and the $9,500 for the motion for contempt and to reopen the record. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood your position.
Right, because although you know, we assert there are problems with all the conduct-based fees. When you're looking at, you know, specifically with the larger amounts, those are the ones that we're contesting.
Thank you.
Turning to the issue of spousal maintenance, there is no uncertainty here as to respondent's self-support. The trial court held respondent will be self-supporting in 4 years. Appellant disagrees that it's going to take 4 years. I mean, we have a situation where wife owns her own dental practice. Her dental practice at the time of trial supported earnings sufficient to meet her reasonable needs given the marital standard of living. And the dental practice accountant testified that the practice presently supported a dentist at $194,000 a year. Wife does not need 4 years to reach $170,000. The trial court also erred in limiting respondents' income to $40,000 for those 4 years in determining respondents' need for temporary spousal maintenance to be $6,000 a month. As the sole owner of the dental practice, in 2017, respondent had earned subchapter S income of $20,851, resulting in income to her of $60,851. Further, the record's undisputed that during the marriage, respondent's salary was kept artificially low in order to limit her tax contributions. Funds were transferred from her dental practice to appellant's business to support a retirement plan, half of which benefits were awarded to respondent.
But there was testimony at trial that it was your client who made all of the decisions with regard, and I'll talk about the Robbinsdale dental practice now, not the prior one, but made the decisions, including but not limiting to increasing the practice from 2.5 to 4 days and setting the wife's pay at $40,000 a year.
Right, and that was done for the benefit of the parties, because specifically by limiting her income tax-wise and then having the money shifted over where there were no employees in his corporation, they were able to fund retirement plans, half of which she received. And the fact of the matter is she was actually the one that was doing the bookkeeping for her own practice. And all of this, appellant left the practice in August of 2017. So, I mean, here we have a situation where, I mean, she's been running the practice for years at the time of the 2019 trial. And if there hadn't been this tax device in place, I mean, you're going to have additional subchapter S income to respondent, and her income would have been higher yet. So it was really error in limiting wife's income for 4 years to $40,000. And my final issues I want to talk about are the attorney's fees, which we touched on briefly. If you look at the multiple orders of conduct-based fees, the trial court appears to apply a standard that if you do not prevail on your motion, fees are awarded to the other side. And that's not the standard under Minnesota law, as the court is well aware. A particular concern is the fact that appellant was ordered to pay respondent's fees for the fourth day of trial, as well as $100,000 in need-based fees.
I'm trying to get a sense for that fourth day of trial. The trial judge made comments throughout that your client's trial attorney used a lot more time up to the fourth day than the wife's attorney did. And for instance, used time to have foundation laying witnesses and that sort of thing, where a lot of times parties will just agree to the foundation instead of having to call witnesses. So I'm trying to get a sense for that. And what is your sense? I know that you weren't the trial attorney, but when you read the record, what do you think? There are lots of observations by the trial judge about that.
Well, when I read the record, what I see is the fact that because my client is the respondent and petitioner goes first, that there was a lot of cross-examination. And so that takes time. And as the trial court itself recognized, respondent was a reluctant witness, and there was some trouble getting her to answer the questions directly. In any trial, as the court is well aware, there's going to be issues with regard to offers of proof, et cetera. But what the trial court said in setting out the order was saying each party should have half of the time. Well, when the trial court set that order, first, the trial court didn't recognize initially it itself was going to take part of the time on the first day for the in-camera interview of the children. And it was very clear to the trial court, actually by the end of the first day, that this case was very complex and it didn't allocate enough time. And so if the trial court is looking at the time that's taken by the parties, the court should look at all 4 days. And when you look at the transcript of the fourth day, now the court took it off the clock at the third day, but if you look at the fourth day transcript, what you see is most of the time is taken up by respondent's attorney. And it makes sense because at that point, it is the appellant that is on the stand and you have the cross-examination of the appellant and some of the other witnesses. So it really doesn't make any sense that you would just cut it off the time at day three when you decide, and I've quoted to the court what the trial court itself said about the need for another day of trial, and say that therefore appellant must pay the respondent $10,000 for the fourth day of trial as conduct-based fees. So, it doesn't fall within the realm of where you have, you know, duplicitous circumstances or, you know, the standard that the court has generally applied where you have, you know, disingenuous. I mean, you have a trial and in a trial you have various disputes and they have to be handled. And it just doesn't, in accord with what I understand conduct-based fees to be, to award it in this circumstance. Attorney's fees were also awarded on a conduct basis because the trial court denied appellant's motion to reopen the record. and denied the motion for contempt, but the trial court was wrong on the law on contempt. And the fact that the trial court decides that it's not going to reopen the record, and there was a good faith basis for that motion, is not a basis to award attorney's fees. So what we have here is we have not the American rule of attorney's fees that everyone pays their own, but the seemingly shifting based on, I guess, the prevailing party, which is not in accord with Minnesota law. And so I ask that this court reverse for the reasons that have been stated in appellant's brief. Thank you.
There we go. Thank you, Ms. Hunt. Mr. Skolnick, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, I am Bill Skolnick, and I represent the respondent, Dr. Rupam Sinha. However, I'm not the attorney that should be making this argument today. It should be Amy Joyce, my law partner, my daughter, and lead counsel at the trial. It is with tremendous personal grief that I inform this court that Amy died on February 9 after losing a 10-month battle with cancer at age 51. I hope that my efforts today will come close to the high bar that she set before this very court in previous cases. On appeal, we're looking at what the trial court did. In both the original and the 123-page amended findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment and decree, the trial court went to great lengths and in great detail in reaching its decisions and laying out the legal and factual bases supporting those decisions. I'll address two of the three issues we filed a cross appeal on. And then due to time constraints, I will try to address some, but not all, of the 11 issues the appellant has raised. The first issue is whether the district court erred in determining the amount and duration of spousal maintenance. Now, under the statute, and this is again where I think the court erred, Minnesota 518-552 sub 3 says when there is some uncertainty as to the necessity of a permanent award, the court shall order a permanent award, leaving it open for the later modification. That is not the standard that the trial court applied. The trial court stated that Ms. Catamani had not shown her needs and inability to become self-supporting or of such amorphous or long-term periods to justify an award of permanent maintenance. Again, that's contrary to the statute. The statute is mandatory. Now, the district court, in its order on the motion for amended findings, concludes and states that Robbinsdale Dental makes historical, that Robbinsdale Dental's records make historical revenues unreliable to determine future income to the business, which inevitably leads to the conclusion that the future income is uncertain. And so we are asking that the court rectify the error by changing the designation of the spousal maintenance from temporary to permanent.
How do you respond to Ms. Nordhunt's contention that the 20 some dollars in sub S should have been included in the income?
Yeah, the net income of Robbinsdale Dental is one of the issues at trial that did become difficult, if not impossible, because the appellant, the husband, Dr. Deepak Catamani, controlled all of it and received the funds. Now, I do want to point out that in 2016, the tax return, and this was testified at trial, showed a loss of income, a net loss. And so it's with that that I'll turn to very briefly the amount. The court went through the budget of my client, Dr. Sinha. Now, Dr. Catamani and his attorney at trial conceded there was no issue as to ability to pay. That's not the issue. The issue is the marital standard of living. And on that, in fact, it was the appellant who hired an expert that provided their own spending analysis. And I'll just give two short examples we talked about. One was on clothing. Their expert testified that the monthly spending was $981 a month during the marriage. And the judge cut that severely in half. Then the other issue is that $1,000 for travel and vacations. They have that budget too, the judge did, even though the spending analysis showed it was close to $900 a month. Dr. Sinha's parents, the grandparents, live in the UK, and part of the marital standard of living was traveling to visit them outside the country. I now want to address some of the other issues on this appeal raised by the appellant, and I want to start by hopefully providing some context about the very issue that Ms. Hunt discussed, and that is the fidelity accounts and attorney's fees.
Mr. Skolnick, I was going to ask you, what evidence supports the district court's finding that the husband's father intended to give the funds in the bank accounts or fidelity accounts to both husband and wife and not just to husband?
Well, again, the district court, because the district court did determine that, and unlike the case that was cited, that it was opened by the husband during the marriage. So the presumption is if this account was opened during the marriage, it's marital. Then the husband not only was the primary principal account holder, he also paid taxes and income on it. Now, that wasn't the only reason. The judge also based it on the credibility of Dr. Catamani and his father, and found them not to be credible. In addition, other subsequent actions demonstrated the intent. What happened was, during the marriage, shortly after they separated, the funds were taken out of that account to buy a condo in Minneapolis, which ultimately, very quickly thereafter, Dr. Catamani bought the adjoining unit and put the two into one. So what we have are funds that were used to acquire a condo in Dr. Catamani's name, not his father's, but in Dr. Catamani's name.
Can I just ask a clarifying question about that?
Yes.
It was unclear to me when the two condos were combined, if it became one condo or if there's still two condos.
The testimony was, and I believe the finding by the court was, that they took out the walls that separated them and made it into one unit.
So for purposes of a property record, who owns that piece of property?
I believe at one point there were two separate titles, and I don't know whether they'd been combined or not. And that evidence wasn't... I don't believe in the court.
Yeah, that was my question. Thank you.
Yes. So let me try to add some context. Here's what the trial court saw. The trial court, in evidence, saw, number one, that Mr. Kaminsky, the expert of appellant, in addition to the other reasons the judge found this issue about surprise was nonsense. So he listed a bunch of factors in his finding. In denying the reopening of the record and the surprise about the joint accounts, here's what the court saw. Number one, in addition to him being Dr. Catamani being questioned during his deposition about it, in addition to the fact that there were all these exhibits that were on the exhibit lists, in addition to all the things the judge added, and he put in one sentence, he heard the testimony of the parties and experts. Dr. Cadamani and Mr. Sobel, on June 14th, 12 days before trial, presented us with the report, Exhibit 136, from Mr. Kaminsky. And Mr. Kaminsky, on it, if you read the one-page cover sheet on Exhibit 136, came up with some analyses and conclusion. And right above his signature, he says, DK, which is obviously Mr. Cadamani, has never deposited any money into these Fidelity accounts. He's not received any cash distributions, nor has he reported any taxable income. To say that the appellant and his counsel were surprised when they hired their own expert who prepared and presented an analysis is, if you're the trial court, you're saying, wait a minute, after I issue my decision, and I'll say you were surprised by this when you presented your own expert witness who analyzed those accounts. And that hole, which justifies the attorney fee award, got deeper at trial. Because at trial, when Mr. Kaminsky was on the stand, Mr. Sobel had him acknowledge his report, Exhibit 136. On cross-examination, I cross-examine, and here's what the court listened to. Number one, Mr. Kaminsky admitted that he was hired to analyze those accounts. Two, he was paid $25,000 for his analysis. And number three, he was dead wrong on whether or not the income from those accounts were reported on the tax return. While he's on the stand, Mr. Kaminsky later says, well, at some point he acknowledged he had made a mistake and he was wrong. He said, but I calculated what the tax would be and I had that schedule with me. Out pops what was marked and received in evidence, Exhibit 136P. When I asked Mr. Kaminsky, and I'll give you a cite to the record, page 678 of volume 4, about the schedule, when did you prepare it? He prepared it before trial, a few days before he testified. Who'd you give it to? I gave it to Mr. Sobel. Mr. Sobel never presented that to us. So you're the judge listening to this. Wait a minute, you put the expert on and you're telling me you're surprised by all this. How can you be surprised when you had this expert witness analyze it? And then finally, when it was brought on a cross-examination, Mr. Sobel at page 685 goes back and tries to clean it up by saying, well, I forgot to ask you about that hidden exhibit. That is the context in which the judge has heard motion after motion. And after the decision is rendered, they come in and say, we're surprised. There was no surprise. And in fact, to suggest that the motion had any merit based on surprise to reopen the record regarding the Fidelity accounts is not only disingenuous, it's intellectually dishonest, and it's just not true. I want to talk about, there was a question about, about the Birmingham flat. And Ms., I want to point out that it was owned premarital, no question about that. There were no marital funds expended. There was no effort put in during the marriage. In fact, it was managed by her brother, Ravi, who maintained it. And in addition, her father and brother paid off the mortgage. There's no funds received by the parties, that is Mr. and Mrs. Dr. and Dr. Cadamani, and now Dr. Sinha. No funds were received. And so when the trial court made its determinations, that is what it focused on and determined it was not a marital asset. Finally, in regards to the...
Well, let me just ask you on that last point, Mr. Skolnick. If your client remained the owner of that flat, where did the rental money, rental fees go then over this many year period of time? I mean, isn't that her income regardless of who she entrusts it to?
She had given her brother the power of attorney. He's the one that reported all the income, as the judge found in his findings. He reported all the income on his tax returns. He kept all the funds, did all the work, managed the property, and paid off the mortgage.
Is there something in the record to say that he didn't use that rental income to pay off the mortgage?
Yes. I don't have that cite, but he was asked about that.
I see.
So, yes.
All right, thank you.
Unless there's any questions, I'll rest.
Seeing none, Ms. Hunt, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Turning first to the issue of the joint accounts, I want to be clear that there was no gift by appellant's father to either appellant or respondent. The funds were always those of appellant's father.
Ms. Hunt, is there record evidence as to who actually bought the first condo? I think it was 1513. And then I thought there was evidence also that your client was paying rent to his father for that. What evidence is in the record on those issues?
The evidence in the record is that appellant's father bought the condominium, that the money was transferred from the Fidelity account to purchase the condominium unit, I think it's 1513, and that appellant did pay rent. The reason that appellant was seeking to reopen the record was because although the trial court recognized that it was from the Fidelity account that went to pay for that condominium, because it had never been included on any of what a respondent had submitted or any expert, that the condominium was somehow marital property. That's why appellant moved to reopen the record, just so all that documentation was available in the record. So that was the reason for reopening the record.
But Ms. you say that, so the judge at finding 337 concluded that the father has not shown that the Fidelity accounts were a gift or bequest to him as one spouse alone. I mean, the husband didn't. So it seems implicit in the judge's findings that he found that it was a gift to both spouses.
With Your Honor, on this record, there's no evidence of a gift to anybody. I mean, a gift requires clear and convincing evidence of the donor's intent, which would be appellant's father, to immediately transfer the funds irrevocably to the parties. Instead, appellant's father testified at trial that his son and his daughter have no present interest in any of the joint accounts on which they are on with him that he funded.
And then the judge balanced that testimony against the husband's testimony and the tax returns, the deposition testimony, that is.
No, I mean, you can't, because one, the tax returns are irrelevant to the issue of a gift. This court has been very clear that there's that gift law and tax law do not coincide. So the fact of who paid taxes is irrelevant.
I'm looking at footnote 277, and that's for the deposition of your client. He said, if they're reported on our accounts, I would imagine there are funds.
Right, and he also then testified in his deposition, but I'd have to look at the accounts. Okay, so he wasn't looking at the accounts.
But he also said that he would not declare in his own income tax records accounts in other people's names.
Well, the fact is, but again, it makes no difference, because you have to show that there was clear and convincing evidence of intent by appellant's father to lose control of the funds he put in the joint account and that they're now belonging to appellant. There's no evidence of that, none. And the trial court would have to find clear and convincing evidence of it. There's no findings of fact of that. And if you look at the proposed findings, which I think are interesting, appellant in his proposed findings said, you know, there's no evidence of a gift, and respondent in her proposed findings puts in no evidence. He doesn't assert there's a gift, none at all. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence in this record that coincides with a gift. And absent that, I mean, the funds are the father's and they cannot be marital property. Briefly, with regard to the spousal maintenance issue and the amount of her needs, the report is by our expert are the expenses of respondent and her daughter, not just respondent alone. So respondent's misreading that in making its argument that the record somehow would show that the trial court's findings were clearly erroneous in that respect.
All right, thank you, Ms. Hunt. And Mr. Skolnick, the matter was extensively briefed, and we appreciate the briefing in the matter, particularly considering the limited time you had to present your arguments here today, but the briefs were of great help in understanding your arguments. So we thank you for that, and the matter was well presented. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we'll issue our decision within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you.